Welcome to the Independent Curriculum Group's Partner Podcast. The Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast highlights the work of our partner schools in the development of contemporary education as they embrace and enact the ICG's principles of independent curriculum, which you can find on our homepage at independentcurriculum.org. The Independent Curriculum Group is a consortium of over 150 schools around the world interested in building stronger, more effective programs. The ICG helps schools envision, design, implement, and evaluate school-generated, mission-aligned curriculum. Because independent curriculum is created in individual schools by teachers to serve their very own students, independent curriculum is innovative by definition. We hope that you will find this podcast both interesting and inspiring, and we hope that you will subscribe to our entire Partner Podcast series. Welcome to this episode of the Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the ICG and host of the Partner Podcast. Today we're talking with Kimberly Berndt, a member of the Science Department at St. Mark's School in Southborough, Massachusetts. Kim, thank you for joining us for the ICG Partner Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's great to be here.
So first, Kim, can you tell us a little bit about St. Mark's School, please? How old it is, a little about the students, mission, values?
So St. Mark's School, just about 2 years ago, I guess, had our 150th anniversary. So founded in 1865, we're a pretty small boarding school. 365 students, 75% are boarders, and then 25% day. International population is about 21%, and I think we represent somewhere around 13 states in any given year. I think St. Mark's is it lives in its community. It's definitely a small school, we say intentionally, but I think the students and the faculty feel that as well. The community's probably our greatest strength and really speaks to what happens in the classroom.
Great. Thank you very much. And how did you come to be at St. Mark's? Can you tell us a little bit about your path to the school and the work you're doing there now and your role there?
So I started teaching straight out of college. I was actually a 1993 Teach for America Corps member and was initially placed in New Orleans, but just as things happened, I ended up in rural North Carolina for 2 years. And then since then have been in both public and private, large and small schools across the country from Connecticut to Texas. And one thing I guess I would say is that I've definitely learned that kids are kids and students are students. And while the culture of the school matters, just understanding that we're all human has been a through line for me and every place I've taught. I was in Texas prior to coming to St. Mark's, and for family reasons, we decided we need to get closer to a city, and I looked for schools, and St. Mark's was looking for a science department head, which I thought would be a new challenge for me. So I came to St. Mark's to help kind of guide the science program at St. Mark's into a new direction, thinking about the possibility of having a new building, which we now have, a STEM center, and thinking about teaching and learning in the 21st century. So that's how I got here. Since I've been at St. Mark's now, I guess I just finished my seventh year. I stepped down as department head. I really felt the need to get back into the classroom full time. It's where I'm happiest, and I feel like I'm most vibrant. And I feel like probably in the past 7 or 8 years has been the greatest rate of growth I've had as an educator. And I think that speaks to both St. Mark's as a school and the type of growth that we're having as a community, but also to where I am in my career and what I understand. I think the more you know, the faster you're able to learn. And so my foundation has definitely increased. The past 7 years, you know, I think I started with a focus on really developing effective curriculum in my classes in terms of student-centered, but teacher directed. And in the past 2 years, I've had a new focus, which is to really start thinking about how do we develop student directed learners.
Fantastic. I'm going to ask a strange question, maybe. It certainly in living memory, at least my living memory when I was in college, St. Mark's was, I think, proudly known as a pretty conservative prep school for boys. Well, St. Mark's has been co-ed for decades, and a few years ago, the school stopped offering advanced placement designated courses and really embraced a more academically forward-thinking approach to teaching and learning. St. Mark's current strategic plan includes a Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning, Global Citizenship, and has a huge emphasis, as you just referenced, on STEM. I'm wondering what's it like to be a part of a school with such a focus on its own transformation, and you know, what's it like for you to hear, you know, me characterize the school, you know, long before you came, possibly before you were born.
You know, it's not surprising to hear that because it still exists to some degree. And I think this is a challenge for all schools that have a long history. There's a tension between tradition and innovation. And I think we're really feeling that right now, especially as some of our innovations are rolling out. There's that pull, that tension. Wait a minute, who are we and who were we? And I think also this, you know, transcends beyond St. Mark's. We've always had pretty good students that would perform well in our environment, whatever we decided that environment was. And so I think we've been able to fall back, and I'm saying collectively because I've taught at other independent schools in New England and across the country, I think we've been able to fall back on traditional methods of teaching and assessment because our students will do it, even if it wasn't necessarily the best, but they were getting into good schools. And so we assumed it was good enough and it was working. And what I've noticed in the past decade is that as our teaching practices become more innovative and our assessment practices become more purposeful and open, that our students are learning a lot more. And we have this really exciting space to really practice and try new things in our schools where we don't have, you know, the stress of state tests, and that we really should be using our schools as incubators for thinking about pushing teaching and learning to the next level and not being satisfied with what we had in the past. So I'm not surprised to hear that, and we definitely feel that tension. You know, the innovations that are happening at St. Mark's have been fast and furious at times, and I love change, and I've even felt at times like everything needs to slow down, we need to stop and reflect, and I've said that, and but now I think the past 2 years we've actually made some more purposeful decisions to not make, to try any new changes, to just continue with what we had planned. When I started at St. Mark's is when all these conversations were starting about this concept of STEM and this concept of a center and global. And I remember saying what's important is that you can't do, and I was the voice for STEM, we can't do STEM well if it's not global. And I don't think you can do global if you don't include STEM, because so many global challenges require STEM. And we can't do STEM well if we're not using the best practices for teaching and learning, so we need the center. So these three innovations, or three, you know, foci need to be integrated. And so I think we're starting to get there. We're starting to see more of those overlaps as we progress.
I think you've just referenced a really important synergy in the way we think about teaching and in the way we think about evolving our schools. I think you're absolutely right that best practices, global thinking, and thinking around particularly STEM, but all aspects of that, including, I would say, the design part of STEM that we often think of as the A to make STEAM, the arts. But I think that's really, really a powerful observation. And one that we all need to keep in mind, that you can't just kind of go off on one track without having
real strengths happening in the others as well, other strengths developing in the others.
Exactly.
So, Kim, when we spoke before, you mentioned some things that have mattered to you in your evolution as a teacher, especially about being reflective about your work. And I think we've just heard a little bit of an example of how you do that. I'm thinking about, too, those aha or, oh, how could I have moments that we have sometimes in the classroom or just after a classroom, and we suddenly see how we could do things better. And I'm wondering how you, and maybe how you spot and grab these as they go by, and I'll add to that how you maybe support colleagues in learning how to do this as a collaborative process rather than just as something that happens to individual teachers at 5 o'clock in the morning or in the shower or on the way home.
Exactly. You know, I think for those people that watched Monk, that he always talked about a gift and a curse. And I feel like my tendency to reflect is both a gift and a curse because I sometimes can't turn my brain off. And that drives me a little crazy. But I'm always reflecting on what I'm doing and what's happened in the classroom, but also what's happening during the classroom. I read some literature from, I think it was Rogers and Rader Roth, on the presence, being present in the classroom. And I realized that one of my strengths is that I prepare so much for being in the classroom that once I'm there, I'm able to be present. And part of being present is to watch what's going on, observe, but also be reflective at that moment and think about what purposeful actions can be taken in the classroom. So I think reflection is so, so important, not just for me, but also for my students. And we can talk about that more later. But I reflect before I get into the classroom, while I'm in it, and then a lot afterwards. And I try to find those colleagues that also want to reflect and just kind of debrief about what's happened, what's working, what's not. And I think the other thing with reflection is to recognize that it's not, I have one conversation and I'm going to solve a problem, but to have a conversation that gets you thinking so that maybe an hour later, maybe like you said, in the shower the next day, or maybe 2 years later, you have that aha moment of, oh, that's what we were talking about. And this is how we could make teaching and learning better. I'll stop there.
<That's>... I'm going to stop here to remind listeners that this is the Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast. I'm Peter Gao of the ICG, and with me today is Kim Byrne of St. Mark's School in Massachusetts. Kim, one of our principles of independent curriculum at the Independent Curriculum Group is the idea of creating learning experiences that are really aligned to the needs and capacities and culture of the kids in one's own classroom at one's own school. We were born out of the desire to step away from sort of canned or mandated curricula, I think. And that's, to me, the essence of that is thinking about the kids who are in the room with you. You've mentioned to me that you've had lots of occasions to include students' voices and students' ideas and feedback as you've developed your own very independent curriculum. And I'd love for you to share some of these experiences. And I would really call them practices, and I'll go to say they're best practices with me and with our listeners.
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent of student voice in all ways, and I try to model that a lot in my classroom. So I ask students for their feedback frequently. And I also model, I think, which goes hand in hand, my own reflection practice with my students so that they understand that if I change a policy or if I change a due date for an assignment or if I change anything, that there's been some reflection, some thinking. And very often that reflection involves what I've noticed with my students. So if I notice they're more stressed in a given week or that they've been working really hard but they're still challenged with the topic, I'll talk about that openly. And so that they know that my changes are purposeful. They're very deliberate. And I also ask my students to, you know, I've been trying to really get them to reflect more consistently about their own learning. But in the process of those reflections, they often give me, whether I asked for it or not, feedback about how the course is going. Usually I do ask for it, but sometimes even when they're just talking about their own learning, I can get feedback about what practices I'm using or working, where I can improve. So those are two things that are kind of daily, and my kids laugh at me because I say, I'll just say, on my walk this morning, I was thinking, and they just start to laugh because they know there'll be this whole reason about why I'm going to change something. But they definitely appreciate it, and I think it develops their trust in our classroom, and they know I'll listen to them. The other things, something I tried new this year, which was really beneficial, was in the middle of a course that was very different from any course I'd ever taught, and very student directed, and really transformed the paradigm of what teaching or what learning was like at St. Mark's. In this classroom, it was very student directed. I asked the students halfway through to engage with me in a modified format of critical friends. So in a typical critical friends, you're usually working with colleagues and you ask them to look at, say, a lesson, and there's a moderator who has your colleagues discuss the lesson in your presence, and they focus on areas that you want them to focus on. So whether it's the assessment, evaluation, or something like that. I asked my academic dean to do this with my class. So I had a class, I think we had 18 kids in the class this year, and we got into a conference room for about 85 minutes. And I prepped my students ahead of time. And what I wanted them to do is just talk about how the course was working for them. And so it wasn't exactly critical friends, but it was very similar. And it was such a rich conversation, and they uncovered so many things I hadn't even uncovered, including one of my goals years ago had been to really make these, to personalize the learning that was happening in the classroom. Now, how do you do that? It's a great design question in education. How do we personalize learning? And so much of it is always, they talk about with blended learning, you know, it's just quizzes, and then you tell students to go study this because you didn't do well in this concept. And I didn't like that idea, that concept of personalized learning. But one of my students in this session said, this is the most personalized learning I've ever had. And I realized that I had done this in a very different way. And I would never have known that if we hadn't had this critical friend session. And my students afterwards were just, they were blown away. They said, this was the coolest thing. We've never been able to just talk openly about a course, how it was going, about our learning with our teacher there. And they also, at least they said, and feel no threat of, you know, response like, oh, she'll be upset or she'll be hurt. And so I think it was a really great experience, and I intend to do it again. And I encourage teachers to try it with their kids, even in just small bits.
I'm just dumbstruck by that, because it seems to me that you have just solved the whole, how do we collect, you know, good feedback from kids on our teaching? How do we, you know, talk to our teachers about the work they're doing and really understand that? And all I can think of is the level of trust that goes into, that must go into that kind of setting, because you have to trust your academic dean to hear student voices with great honesty. They have to trust you and trust the dean as well, the students do. I think this is a wonderful idea. And rather than, you know, struggle to create the perfect questionnaire format for collecting student data on teaching, why don't we just do this? I would love to know if you have written that protocol up, because I think that would be a tremendous resource for lots of other people. I would encourage you to do that. I think that's terrific. Well, thank you. Wow.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, too, the other one of our partner podcast goals is to make sure that our listeners have a chance to know what the people we're speaking to are reading and listening and talking about. So if you could please talk a little bit for our listeners about the ideas, the books, thought leaders, other kinds of resources that have perhaps inspired you and that have inspired and guided you and the others involved in the transformational work that you all are doing at St. Mark's. Who have you been reading? Who have you been listening to and talking to and even just thinking about as all this work has been going on? And maybe, you know, what have been the great influences perhaps on you as a teacher?
That's a great question. So I think to answer that, I've got to go back about probably 7 years, my first or second year at St. Mark's. And accidentally, I came across an article from Carl Wieman, who is a Nobel laureate in physics. And he, after winning the Nobel Prize, really started to focus on undergraduate education, science education, because he was realizing that these exemplary students that were ending up in his lab as graduate students really didn't understand physics, despite what their transcript said. And so he wrote an article, say, I think it was like, why don't we take a scientific approach to science teaching? And in this article and a few others, because I started to stalk him and read everything that I could, he referenced the concept of being an expert. And in that, he also referenced, I think the book is Talent is Overrated by Colvin, I think it was. And so I read that book immediately. And between his article and the book, started to really reflect on this concept of one talent, and we talk about kids, and we do this, and I think this brings in growth mindset, fixed mindset. We talk about kids as, oh, they're English students or they're science students, but this book and the work of Carl really demonstrates that we don't know what talent is. We can't define talent statistically or in any other way, but what we can define and what we can measure and what we can have researched is how do people become experts? How do we move from a novice to an expert? And as I read this book and reflected, I realized that over my career, those special students, that you know, that one or two that appear every once in a while, that really seem to dig into learning, that have this knack of asking those really important questions, that complete assignments for complete understanding, not for completion, that do have all of those kind of criteria that we think, oh, they're special students, they actually were exhibiting the practices of a developing expert. And so as I read this, I remember that year thinking, what if, bringing in some design thinking, what if we developed curriculum that developed those strategies in our students? What if all students were equipped with thinking about learning as an expert does? So it's not just facts, but it's how do we organize content around major concepts? How do we deal when there's an event with cognitive dissonance? How do we think about that? How do we, within all of everything with experts, they reflect all the time. They synthesize. They engage in deliberate practice, you know, practice that's not just to do 100 of the same problem, but practice that's purposely designed to improve in some parameter. And so I really worked over the next 5 years or so in developing curriculum. I primarily teach advanced biology curriculum that brought those practices into play. And I also realized that some of the things that I did in the classroom already that were really effective were because they were deliberate practice or they involved reflection. So I there was this synergy that was happening. And so over the next 5 years, I really worked on developing students to be expert thinkers. And I talked to them about it too. I was very transparent. And in that process, you know, they would joke about the number of hours to be an expert and how much they'd have to study biology. And I said, I don't care if you're an expert in biology, but I want you to be equipped to be able to be an expert in anything that you want to be. And so over those years, what I kept hearing from my students was how much they were learning. And that's what I was seeing with those special students. They were able to learn at such a faster rate. Why was that? And I think it's because of how they organized content, how they thought about it, how they were deliberate, how they reflected. And so I saw huge improvements, and I was feeling pretty good about myself, to be honest. I was like, I've developed this great course. Kids are learning a lot. They're learning how to be learners. They're learning biology. This is wonderful. And then about 2 years ago, right after the first early decision deadline happened for college, so November 1. I was teaching a group of seniors that I had taught the year before in advanced bio, and they were great students. And they pretty much fell apart. They lost interest. We had this just disastrous class, which shouldn't have been. It was something I taught before. It works. And they just weren't thinking, and they weren't engaged. And I just ran into most of their college recs where they were such engaged learners. So I was really disappointed and really frustrated. And I reflected. I took about 36 hours before I saw them again and took some time to reflect. And we actually just took the long block, and I said, what do you want out of being a senior? What do you want out of your education? What do you think an elective should be like? And we realized that we wanted to blow up this elective curriculum. And in the process, and they said that, you know, they wanted voice and choice, and we hear this all the time. So I gave it to them, and they got to design their unit for the next 3 weeks, and there were three or four groups doing this, and they were excited. And at the end of those 3 weeks, it was absolute failure. It was disastrous. They were horrible at it. They had no idea how to direct their own learning. And that started me off on the journey that I've been on in the past year and a half of how do we equip students to be self-directed learners? And in that process, you know, simultaneously, I'm doing some graduate work at USC, which has been great because I've had professors that have given me the latitude to kind of take what's happening in my classroom and play with it in their courses. And I started to realize that while my curriculum, my advanced bio curriculum, was very deliberate and it included preflections and purposeful, deliberate practice and synthesis of learning and then reflection, and it was in that process, the kids did what I prescribed for them to do. And so I realized that the next step, and they were good at it, and they were good about thinking in different ways and taking ownership over their learning, but it was still on a very teacher-directed way, even if it was student-centered. And so what I realized was I wanted students to become more reflective learners. I wanted that, and so I termed it the reflective learning mindset. How do we develop students to think about what they want to learn, come up with purposeful ways to learn that, to be able to evaluate their understanding without a test, without a paper assigned by a teacher, to reflect on that, and then to move on, just as an expert does. So it actually brought me full circle back to this expert thinking model. And, you know, I would probably say I'm on revision, I don't know, 79, 83, 105 of these scaffolds. But I've started to make some real progress, I feel, in developing that. And I think that speaks to your earlier question about when we think about our students. And that's been a driving force for me, which is how do we create scaffolds to help students become better student-directed learners that are flexible enough that can be used in a variety of environments so that they'll work for different schools, provided you can modify them for your students. And if there's a tension there, right? You want it to be general enough that it works for a range, but you also have to, the practitioners, the educators have to be present enough to reflect and think about how do I make this work best for my students at whatever age or capacity they have at that moment.
Wow. Well, that's so much to think about, and it makes me want to come and visit your class, and I suspect it will make some of our listeners want to come and visit your classroom as well and kind of see how that goes, and maybe we'll check back in a while and see how the evolution is going for you. I guess the question I sort of find myself asking, and I sort of hate myself for thinking about it, but it's the question about, I'm going to say it, content, that I think this is the great challenge that I think especially, well, I think everybody has, but perhaps science and math and language teachers feel the pressure more intensely about, okay, I want my kids to be reflective learners. I want them to think about learning in the sort of this expert model, but somehow I think as a teacher and the standardized testing people sometimes think as well, that there is a certain body of information that kids just need to pour into their heads at least long enough to pour it out at some point. And I'm sort of wondering, how do you keep the balance between those things?
Right. That's a great question. You know, I wish I had a great answer. but, you know, I feel like, now I believe one thing. One thing I believe is that teaching with this kind of expert thinking construct actually does allow students to learn more and learn more deeply. So if you can distill down in your discipline what are those foundational concepts and really ensure that those concepts are revisited, they're spiraled through the curriculum, you know, use all of the cognitive science that we understand about learning, teaching and learning, that they can learn more than you realize in the course of the year. And that's what my students always say. They say, I've never learned so much in a course as I did this year. And yet I'm not content driven. I mean, we cover a lot of content, or I hate to use the word cover, it's the worst verb ever, but we explore a lot of content, but they do really feel like they've learned it. Now that's depth. Now breadth, there's definitely things that we don't get to every year, and probably about April of every year is where I start my descent into depression, realizing, feeling like a failing teacher because we didn't get to this unit or to this concept. Because, and part of it is our school. I mean, our school in particular, St. Mark's, has made some decisions. And this is why I was always a proponent of moving away from the AP curriculum. Because in all honesty, the AP curriculum now for biology, since it's been rewritten, is a great curriculum. I completely believe in it. I think it's great. I think the exam is actually a really good exam. But we start after Labor Day. We have a schedule that only meets 3 times a week. We miss days, class days, for events that are important for our school, community and equity days and great colloquium days and other things that are important and I think are valued, and that's good. But in the process, there's less time in the classroom or out of the classroom for students to work. We also understand the kids need to sleep. And if they're not sleeping, they're not learning, and they're under more stress, and that causes, as a bio teacher, a whole host of biological, you know, effects. So, you know, I think we have to be, as educators, especially I think as high school educators that feed these certain colleges, we have to be courageous and say when enough is enough. And yes, teach content. I am not, I mean, anyone that's in my classroom knows that I care about the content and I care about the terminology and explaining deeply and all of that. But, you know, pick and choose what's foundational. Focus on, you know, along with content is skills or practices. And, you know, I talk to my students about this a lot. I could get you to get a 5 on the AP exam, and you might not know how to write scientifically. And what that means is when you hit college, you're going to struggle because you can't write scientifically if you want to be a science major. So a priority for me is developing the ability to write scientifically. That takes away from, yes, covering more content. But I think that I remember back as being a student, and when I listen to current students, writing in science is a huge practice. So we can't do it all. And I think we have to move away from thinking that we can, because when we try to do it all, it's our students and our teachers that are really, but especially our students, that we stress out, and they don't deserve that. We have to make a shift, and I think we have to be the courageous educators to make that shift. And I think colleges are starting to make it, from what I'm hearing, from what I'm reading, at least in science, they're making that shift. And I got to say, Carl Wieman is forcing that shift as well. I think he's at Stanford now, working in both the physics and education departments and really doing a lot of work with undergraduate science education, saying, talking about cognitive load, talking about lectures don't work. You know, how do we really get deliberate practice into the classroom? And if we do that, yes, we're not going to cover just as much content.
Wow. So I'm thinking, I've got a question here, and we're headed sort of conclusionward. But I'm sort of thinking about, how would you like to see the kinds of things that are happening at St. Mark's and in your own classroom spread to other schools and other educational realms? Sometimes I like to think there's a movement here that has a coherent theme and message. What do you think? Is there? Can this be a movement? I think you've just touched on all of the most critical aspects of not only education, but the lives of students and of teachers.
Yeah, I hope there's a movement. I think there is. You know, on good days, I feel like there is. And when I get on my Twitter feed, and I think Twitter has been transformational for me, and I'm not a social media person per se, but professionally, just to see what other people are doing out there, because that motivates me to think, oh, I'm behind. I need to catch up. I need to try something new. So it keeps me on my toes. And I think I think collectively we have to be courageous and keep each other up on those days that we feel stressed out, or we ask the question, am I doing the right thing for my kids? And I think we all ask that, especially those of us that are really trying to rethink education, rethink what's best for students based on what we know and the world in which we live. So I think it has to be a movement, because it's going to be hard if it's just an individual here and there. It's hard to keep it up. And I can't say that St. Mark's needs to, you know, share this with everyone, because I think so many people have things to share with us. So it's a symbiotic relationship. You know, since I started teaching, I realized I could steal ideas from anyone and anywhere. I was stealing from middle school history teachers my first year teaching. It had nothing to do with what I was teaching. So, you know, I think we just, have to be more collaborative and really create opportunities for community. And I think this project here is an example of that, of how we can really catalyze good thinking.
I'm also going to say that in your work, as you've described it, you've sort of embraced the idea that your own failures and that students' failures to kind of put things together well have been key learning experiences for you. And I think that's so powerful. And again, I am forced to ask one of those questions that I wish I didn't even have to think about, and that is, how do you help kids deal with the idea of failure, the idea that taking a risk and not having things work the first time is okay, when, especially at college preparatory secondary schools, the stakes always feel so high?
Yeah, that's good. You know, I think it brings in something that we read a few years ago, Whistling Vivaldi, and talking about stereotype threat, and reading that book, and it talks about I think it was in that book or some other reading related, normalizing the struggle. That if you can normalize the struggle for students, that benefits those that might be affected by a negative stereotype, but it actually helps everybody. I think it helps those kids that maybe have a fixed mindset about their own intelligence. And so when they struggle and then they see everybody struggling, and the key part is then show kids how to then move on. Model for them, okay, how do we be resilient? How does the next step look? And then, you know, ensure that there's some success, you know, and not success, everybody gets a trophy, but real valid success. And so I actually realized that I structured the beginning of my advanced bio course with an exercise that pretty much everybody fails at. It doesn't work. They struggle. They're confused. But it's done in a healthy environment. And I orchestrate it in such a way that everyone learns they can learn from each other. And that those kids that maybe were always getting the perfect scores are struggling too. So that helps those kids that are wondering, should I be in this class? They're like, okay, we're all in here together. And then, it's just, I think it's, again, knowing your students and watching them, being present in the classroom and recognizing who needs what. You know, some of them just need to, you know, try these things and see how that works, and they'll just be resilient and they'll work through it. And other kids need, you know, a pep talk on the side, and other kids need a little bit more direction in the classroom as they're trying to develop the skills so that they can handle the curriculum at that moment. But I really, really do believe that we have to allow kids to struggle and to help them recognize that they are equipped to succeed. And I think that, you bring up actually make me think about something that I'm feeling really strongly about. Because we talk about rigorous curriculum all the time. And a friend of mine always wants to say vigorous, not rigorous. It should be vigorous. And I agree with her. But regardless of the term you use, I think there's two philosophies. The older philosophy, if I can say that, would be a rigorous curriculum is that a course that's really hard, that kids have a really hard time, and there's only a few A's. And my concept of a rigorous curriculum is a curriculum in which you learn the most. You learn more than you ever imagined you could learn. And I think there is still a concept that if you're learning a lot, then maybe it's too easy. And I'm saying, no, you're creating the right learning environment. And if we would just leverage everything that we know about teaching and learning, stereotype threat, growth mindset, grit, all of this, deliberate practice, reflection, if we would harness all of that together, our students are able to learn more than we ever believed. And they'll believe it and we'll see it. And that's where the real growth happens. And to me, that's a rigorous curriculum. So that's what I want to see in the future, is where we're not trying to differentiate student A from student B by an A and a B, but that, and I think it goes to some of the work that you guys are doing, we're thinking about, badging ideas and credentials, and what are the strategies that students are using, and what are the capacities or the skill level that they have in different areas, so that we can develop them and they can learn more and they're able to overcome challenges. It's a convoluted answer, but
to a pretty hard question. So I really appreciate that. Maybe sort of as my final question here, I'm thinking about the independent curriculum group, and our desire is to create a more collaborative culture within certainly the community of our own partner schools. But how can we also support work that teachers like you are doing in our partner schools? What can we do to make your work easier and to spread the ideas and maybe create this movement or grow this movement? How can we help?
Having the organization itself. I think opportunities for people to get together and share ideas, to not feel alone and isolated, because sometimes you do start to feel that way, to recognize you're not crazy, that, that's where I think Twitter has been helpful, because that was something every morning that I can see and say, these are big time researchers, or people that, are moving in this direction. It's not just me thinking this way, or a few of us at our school. And so I think, having opportunities to share ideas and to learn from each other, so that, because that's the thing, I mean, we know this about brainstorming, right? Individual brainstorming gets a certain number of ideas, but then if you collaboratively brainstorm after that, you don't get the sum, you multiply that effect. And I think that's what, groups like this can do, is they can multiply the effect of good ideas in teaching and learning.
Well, thank you. You've just given me perhaps a tagline as well for my own work in communicating with schools. Well, Kim Byrne, thank you so much for your time today. and for your taking some time from your work at St. Mark's School in Massachusetts to speak with us. And also just thank you for the work you're doing at St. Mark's to support, promote, and enact, and I will say explore in a really wonderful way, our principles of independent curriculum, which are just sort of thrown on top of work that you guys are already doing naturally, I think. This has been a really exciting conversation for me, and I'm sure an exciting and inspiring conversation for our listeners. Oh, my gosh. Well, listeners, we're going to be posting Kim's contact information along with the pressy of this podcast on the Independent Curriculum Group website, so that those of you who have been engaged and inspired by this conversation can follow up with your own questions and ideas and resources to help build that synergy and build that community of practice that we are working so hard for. So again, Kim, thank you very much for today. And
thank you.
Listeners, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the ICG, hoping that you will listen to the entire ICG Partner Podcast series and wishing you all the best in your own journey toward the future of education.